accession number 210209, Reel 3.
Freddie Watts, Reel 3.
I think we may have been getting a bit cocky by this time, because hitherto most moon periods were periods when bombers were not sent out. This particular night there was not a full moon, but quite a big one. There was 10/10 of cloud cover. That I think they call it 8/8 these days, but never mind. There was full cloud cover, a strataform cloud, very beautiful to look at about, 10 or 12,000 feet. And it covered virtually the whole of Western Europe. That plus the moon, and we were in the middle, we were silhouetted quite nicely between the cloud and the moon. And it was like shooting fish in a barrel. We went along, and it was the duty of air gunners, whenever they saw an aircraft go down or something explode in the sky, they reported this so the navigator could log it in approximately the position. And after the gunners had reported something like 20 going down, I told them not to report any more because I didn't think it was doing very much for the morale of the crew, especially those poor old boys who were the navigator and the wireless operator, who were just sitting in there and couldn't see out and couldn't see anything. I also noticed that on the track we were keeping, which was with the rest of the force, most of them were going down over on our port side. So I altered course just a few degrees away from it, and then paralleled my course. That was with the navigator's assistance. And I like to think we just kept out of that bit of the mainstream where everybody was going down. And then when we got nearer to Nuremberg, or what we thought was Nuremberg, because it was all under cloud cover, we eased over and went through and bombed what we hoped was Nuremberg. Then coming back, I had won a bit of height, and I must say I put my nose down quickly and got combat strength on the engines and pulled the boost cut out for 5 minutes and went as quickly as I could on the way back. We never had an attack, but when I got back, our AOC was at the station at East Kirkby. He used to go round to various stations on various nights and see the chaps when they came back. And he said, what sort of trip have you had? And I said, well, I think we've caught an awful cold tonight, sir. And he said, oh, you're a bit twitchy. And that was that. So I said, yes, sir. And The following morning, two things happened. One was the announcement, or maybe it was the morning after, but I think it was the following morning. Two things happened. There was the announcement that that many aircraft had, was missing. And the next thing that happened was I was summoned into the squadron commander's office and told that I was posted to 617 Squadron. So it all happened that day after Nuremberg.
Was there any connection with your posting to a different squadron?
Well, yes. We were what they called an H2S crew. You know, map reading radar, and we had the big blister underneath where had the Lancaster been designed differently, there would have been a belly gunner underneath, but there was this radar dome. And my navigator and wireless operator were very, very useful with these. And the commanding officer at 617, who was Leonard Cheshire then, he wanted his own private pathfinding force. And he could get more or less what he liked. And he requested six H2S aircraft from five group, from various squadrons, crews who had had good results. I had already asked to go to either PFF or 617 Squadron. So I was quite happy about that. And so very shortly afterwards, we posted ourselves and took the aircraft from the squadron, took it with us over to 617 Squadron.
This was the 7th of April, apparently.
Hmm?
This apparently was the 7th of April, 1944.
About that time, yes, yes.
What kind of reception did you get at Woodhull Spa?
Well, we got quite a good reception, actually. I mean, we were only sort of half a tour or something like that through, but and there were people walking about there with DSOs and DFCs and what have you, very, very long-term experienced survivors. But all they wanted to know about was Nuremberg. We were given quite a good reception, and they realised that we were not Joe Muggins, so we settled in quite nicely on the squadron.
What did you tell them about Nuremberg?
Well, I told them that I thought we'd pushed our luck. And we were lucky ourselves.
Apparently your first operation with 617 was your 13th, April the 20th to La Chapelle.
Yes. We did some flare dropping at La Chapelle. And I think, I don't know the details too much, but I think Leonard Cheshire went into market with a mosquito and the rest of the squadron went in and bombed it.
What kind of flares were you using?
I couldn't tell you.
And then the next one, 14, was to Brunswick?
Yes, Brunswick was another one where we went and did a bit of flare dropping there. And Brunswick was always a bit of a good burner. There was a lot of wood there, and that seemed to be, I felt more at home being over a German target again.
And 15 was to Milan.
Yes, well, that was a trip which finally earned Leonard Cheshire his Victoria Cross. He didn't win his Victoria Cross for one particular act. It was most unusual, VC. It was for sustained acts of courage over a protracted period. And I must go on record as saying that, for my money, Leonard Cheshire was the greatest bomber pilot who ever lived. I got to know him quite well later on. He went to Munich to bomb a particular factory, and he went in a long-range Mosquito. And he thought it would be a good... and this force was led by 617. Leonard Cheshire marked it. 617, about 20 aircraft, went in with their particular bombs. And it was followed up by five group, about 200 Lancasters. And that followed on behind these boys of our squadron. Cheshire realised that there might be a good harvest for the German night fighters, because that is a very happy little, was a very happy little area there for them. So he thought of the idea of sending six aeroplanes to Milan to do a spoof raid and make all the proper noises over the RT to simulate a main force raid, a pathfinder marking job. He thought these would draw off the fighters from the Munich and Augsburg and all that area. And I was one of the six who went there. We had a high old time over Milan. We made all sorts of noises, and air gunners took old milk bottles and lobbed these out so they make a noise like bombs going down. It was more like it was a long trip, but it was a little soiree, really.
A little what?
Soiree. And it was fairly successful, because the force at Munich did not get very much in the way of fighter attacks. And I'll always remember when I got back, Leonard Cheshire had got back in his Mosquito, and he came up to me and said, what sort of trip did you have? And I remember saying to him, well, sir, I'd go once a night and twice on Sundays if they were all like this. And he said, oh, thank God for that. He said, I've been worrying about you chaps all the evening. And his eyes looked as though they were sewn in by red cotton. He was absolutely played right out. But this wasn't a theatrical gesture. He was that sort of man. So that was Milan.
Then you had a bit of a gap to 5th of June for the 16th operation.
Well, all those were practices for the spoof raid we did on D-Day. You perhaps have heard about that.
Can you tell me about this, please? The spoof raids?
Well, there's been articles written about it.
But your own personal memory of it?
Well, we had been practicing for all those weeks on... Actually, I think a lot of it was done on Norwich Cathedral. We were practicing flying... I think it was five abreast. Very accurately indeed. And dropping a little piece of window you know, the tinsel we used to, silver paper to come up on the radar screen as something more solid. And what we did on the night of D-Day was pick on a piece of coast about 50, 60 miles down from where the beaches were, went over the English Channel, and there were about, 20 aircraft of 617 Squadron. It was either four lines of five or five lines of four flying abreast and going towards the coast, and at a prearranged time, drop a piece of window. And this window showed up on the German radar screen and looked just like a convoy coming across the water. And we did this for 3 hours. What happened was the first line of aircraft would go so far and then do a precision turn back to the back of the queue, and the second line would go in and they would drop a bit of window a little nearer the coast. And it looked like a creeping convoy. I think we did it for 3 or 4 hours. It was rather wearing because it was all in the dark. And any inaccuracy would have made them very suspicious. So it was a success. And that's what we had been training for all those months or weeks. By incidentally, in the meantime, our H2S aircraft had been reclaimed back to our original squadrons because there was a little bit of jealousy going on from PFF, Pathfinder Force, and Sir Donald Bennett, as he later was, objected to anybody doing marking other than the Pathfinder Force. So we had to send the aircraft back, and we just took an aircraft over of 617 Squadron.
And then number 17 was 8th of June to Saumur.
Oh yes, that was a tunnel. I think that was the last one we did on marking. There was, in fact, I think that was the first time we seriously used the 12,000 pounders. Saumur Tunnel was on the line for munitions and what have you. And such was the accuracy of the bomb sight we were using. It was on the official secrets list, the stabilized automatic bomb sight, SABS. The rest of the force used the Mark 14. They dropped a bomb at the mouth of the tunnel and closed it up. And I think somebody went the other end and closed that up as well. And the rest of the bombs were brought back. So that was quite a good operation.
Then 4th of July to Creel.
Creel.
And you put five fighter attacks.
Yes. I don't remember the target particularly, but I do remember that we had... there were one or two fighters made passes at us, but I thought that discretion was the better part of valour you didn't stay to slug it out with them if you saw them first, because they were far more heavily armed. But Creel, I can't remember. In fact, I think that operation is listed under another name, but it was Creel.
But you put in brackets special.
Yes, well, I can't remember quite now why I did it. I'm sorry.
And then 2 days afterwards, on the 6th of July, your first daylight operation to Pas-de-Calais.
Yes, well, we spent a bit of time around there. They're very, 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 very misty, those. I can't really tell you very much about those.
How did you feel about going on to day operations?
Oh, I was quite happy about it. It was rather pleasant, really. We didn't know whether we were going to be infested with fighters, but I must say it was rather pleasant and it was a good summer, rather pleasant to take off at night, rather by day instead of taking off at night with half a fog hanging around and drizzle and God knows what.
Did you have a fighter escort?
Not on Pas-de-Calais, no. I think there's a lot of other activity going on. And I think the Tactical Air Force was doing quite a bit over the other side by that time. So I don't know that the Germans were all that interested in what they considered to be isolated attacks. And so we got away with a fair amount of it.
Then 16th of July, the 20th, was Operation on Wiesenay, another day operation.
Ah, Wiesenay. No, I couldn't tell you. I'm awfully sorry about this, Conrad.
Don't worry.
I was never much of a Samuel Pepys with my logbook.
And 21, you put Operation Wotton.
Wotton. Yes, well, that would be another, possibly a launching site. Or we went a lot after the V weapons. You know, we were looking for the V1s, as they then were, and we were also had inkling of the rocket sites, the V2. And I think Wotton may have been one of those, but it might be worth checking up on.
And then into August, you got a number on La Palice and Brest.
Yes, that's right, yes. Well, they were interesting. We were after the submarine pens. And we went in full daylight. The anti-aircraft, we used to, when we were on main force, we took very little notice of flak, because it's a psychological thing, really. If somebody fires flak at you when it's dark, all you see is the burst. But in daylight, when a shell bursts in the sky, although it's expended itself, the black puff is still there. And it does something to you. You think, God, they've put them there before. I've got to fly through this lot. And the flak round La Palice and Brest was very, very accurate indeed. And we always seem to take the same route in. So we used to say after a couple of trips, well, the German gunners, they've had their breakfast and they've been to the NAFI and they've lined up their guns and they'll be waiting for us. So we did have some good hits on those sub-bends using sort of armour pierce or 12,000 pounders. And there was a lot of flak about. And I mentioned earlier that, I don't know if I mentioned it in the logbook, but coming back from one of those, well, when I arrived back, I put my wheels down and the aircraft caught fire. So by the time I'd got it quickly onto the ground and the fire brigade came along, the aircraft had gone too far to ever fly again. So that was two of His Majesty's aircraft I managed to bring back but destroy.
Yes, that was after an operation on Brest on the 14th of August, you put in the logbook.
What did I put there?
You put hit by flak, aircraft damaged and caught fire in circuit
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Then the 29th operation was the 24th of August on Imoyden.
Imoyden, yes, on the, that was a simple one on the Dutch coast. But they always shot up a lot of flak. But I think that was fairly straightforward.
Then back to Brest on the 27th of August. And then in September, 11th of September, you go to the USSR.
Okay. That's right.
If you can tell me about that, please.
Yes, we took off from, on the, of course, we did, we were after the Tirpitz, and we took off from our base at Woodhull Spa, and we were to fly to Russia and land there, because it was not possible to reach the Tirpitz, hit it, and do the return trip back, fuel-wise. So we took off, we flew, I think we went over Sweden a little bit, who were neutral, and we skirted Finland, who were then having a sort of war with Russia, and we landed at an island in the River Dvina, which is a little bit downstream from Archangel. And on this island was an airfield called Jagodnik. And we were able to fuel up there. And 3 or 4 days later, we went to, I think it was Alton Fjord, where we attacked the Tirpitz for the first time. We then flew back to Jagodnik, and when we were all squared away, we flew back to Woodhull Spa.
Can you describe the attack on the Tirpitz, please?
Yes, they were fairly smart on their smoke screens. They got the smoke across very quickly, but they were firing through the smoke, I think either one or two of the squadron, not myself, put a bomb on the Tirpitz, which damaged it. There were no casualties on that trip, but we had lost a few on the flight out to Russia from the UK, because it was a very close run thing with petrol and what have you. But we didn't lose anything on the actual operation.
How could you be sure that you hadn't hit the ship?
Well, I couldn't be, but I had a feeling that we'd probably got a near miss, a lot of near misses.
Was it difficult going into Alton Fjord?
No. We came from a side they didn't expect us. they wouldn't have expected a heavy force coming in anyway. It was a very well-kept secret, actually. No, they sent up a lot of flak, but nobody seemed to get hit.
What kind of reception did you get at your gardening?
Well, when we arrived at Jagodnik, it was, you know, up there near the land of the midnight sun, and we had a Russian naval band assembled